What's up, my people? It is time to close out the season on the Writer Stuff podcast. I am mid-baseball and mid-swimming season right now with the 10-year-old and the 6-year-old. So time is tight and it's time for a break so I can focus on getting the kids to the end of the school year. Honestly, that's pretty much it. I know I should come up with a really cool reason, but I don't have one. I'm gonna focus on playing dad and not yelling at umpires for the next 2 to 3 months. So, which is harder than you'd expect in 6-year-old baseball. But it's a, I don't know. It's a mob. It's a test of the mob to get parents together and watch a high school umpire blow a call. I'm not proud of it, but I haven't got kicked out of a game yet. So it's so far so good. There will be more on Writer Stuff, the podcast. But I'm going to be playing with some format ideas in the off season, kind of like I did last time when I switched up the title and a little bit of the branding. So there may or may not be changes, when I kick it back off in June or July. But I am in some talks with some parties that will go unidentified as of right now about the future of writing stuff, what we're going to do with the podcast. Very interesting to discuss, but it's all very theoretical at the same time. So I can promise you that whatever happens, it will be, to the benefit of you guys first, and it will be fun because I'm not going to do this for any other reason than if I'm enjoying it. So that's not how I do things. I got the 9 to 5 to do stuff I have to do. Right. But anyway, that is it. More to come is the best I can tell you. So what do you think of that for a cliffhanger to the end of the season? Anyway, if you haven't already, go get Overmatch. It is the perfect summer read, if I do say so myself, because I have seen people reading it on the beach and I think it's a perfect fit. It's fast, it's fun, and, it takes sand really well. So let's get into it. Tonight, I get to talk to author of the Course of Empire series, Brian Nelson. Brian is a former Fulbright scholar who holds degrees in international relations, economics, and creative writing. It's a good mix. His first books, Silence and the Scorpion, an account of the 2002 uprising against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, named one of the best books in 2009 by The Economist. Second book, first one of the Course of Empires series, The Last Swordmaker, hit number one on the Amazon bestseller list. Following a group of military scientists and naval officers who create the world's most advanced military technology and all the fun that comes with doing something like that. He lives in Colorado with his wife and 2 kids. And Brian, thank you for joining me.
Hey, great to be here, John.
Absolutely. When I was checking out your bio, going from engineer to creative writer, that's a swing. Like, always one of those guys that like had a notebook in your pocket at like age 12, or were you like, engineering's fun, but I could also just make stuff up? So how do you make that transition?
Yeah. I've always been kind of all over the place as far as my interests go. And I always liked writing, but I was always thought that was completely impractical. That was just no way to make a living kind of thing. So in college, I studied economics and international relations. And right out of school, I worked as a stockbroker. Then I got hired by a systems integrator up in Detroit, doing work for GM. And that's where I did a lot of computer. They gave me a lot of computer training. And it was just kind of one of those situations where I was, you know, about to hit 30. I actually call this my quarter life crisis because it came, not midlife, quarter life. But basically, it was just kind of looking around and realized that the corporate world wasn't really a good fit for me. I wasn't really happy. And I said, well, why? I felt successful doing it. I felt like I could do it. So I thought, well, why don't I try to do that thing that I thought was unrealistic? Why don't I give that a shot? Right. So I basically, you know, went back to grad school, did 2 years of grad school. Then I got the chance to go to Venezuela to work on that book about Chavez and the coup against Chavez. And that's kind of how it all started. I guess at the beginning, I was always like, well, if I crash and burn in the next few years, I'll just go back to the corporate world. But, you know, we're pushing 24 years. So things are working out okay as far as, yeah, as far as that decision goes. So I've been lucky, move. I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what is that? The, you know, do the thing you love. You never work a day in your life, I guess. But
right,
no,
right.
I was the same way. I was like freshman year of high school. I won a writing competition and never went a day without a notebook in my hand ever since. Wrote about 1,000 awful outlines of awful novels. But the same thing, it was like, yeah, when college comes, it's like, oh, I'm going to go study literature or art. And it's like, and it, thankfully, that blue collar family of mine's like, you do that, you're doing it on your own. we're not paying for that. Very good move in the offing. Yeah. But I parried that blow with saying, okay, I'm going to go be a cop then. Take that. Which not everybody was thrilled with, but it worked out in the end. It was super fun. I was reading, I was like, man, engineer, and just went to writing, but it worked out. And you started the nonfiction as a Fulbright. Was that part of like your Fulbright scholarship? Was that like part of your, I'd hate to say writing a book was an assignment, was it part of the deal? Like they fund you to go to Venezuela?
Yeah. Yeah. You pitch what you want to do. So my pitch was awesome. That I would write like a novel, actually, because my MFA is actually in fiction. And I said, okay, I'm going to go to Venezuela because it's the State Department, right? Fulbright's through the State Department. So they kind of want something that's very rated G, very kind of kumbaya, look how well Venezuela and the U.S. get along kind of thing. And so I was like, well, I'll just write a multi-generational novel, sort of like a Midnight's Children or one of those books that sort of shows the evolution of Venezuela over the last, you know, 50, 60 years, right? And then I got there and it was just the chaos of Chavez sort of moving to take over the democracy, you know, doing all this sort of illegal shifty stuff, the opposition trying to stop him, but then them making really dumb mistakes at the same time. And I was like, this is so crazy. Like this is fantastic enough, right? I don't need to embellish on this, right? So I just said, I'm just going to write about what's going on here. And so the coup had actually already happened. That was in April of 2002. I arrived in the fall, but I was like, it was the sort of most compact sort of situation I could find. It was just sort of 72 hours where this, you know, there's a massive protest. They tried to get Chavez out of power. He calls out the National Guard. He calls out his paramilitary groups. A bunch of people get shot in the street. The military comes in and tries to oust him. They arrest him, and they're about to ship him off to Cuba when he's sort of miraculously rescued and brought back to power. And then from then on out, there was really no chance to get rid of him in many ways. After that, there were no more fair elections. But anyway, so that was the sort of focused, you know, if I can just sort of capture these 72 hours of chaos, I think people will understand what's going on in Venezuela. And that was kind of the idea. And it worked out pretty well because, like, I'm not speaking in the book. Like, it's mm-hmm. just the interview. It's just the people that I met. So you're going from one point of view to the next point of view, and it's kind of tight clocked narrative. Actually, the book that was the big inspiration for that was Mark Bowden's Black Hawk Down. Man, you know, that very short, intense.
Yeah.
And I actually reached out to him. He was very helpful. He gave me some ideas and I met with him a couple times actually. But yeah, that book is amazing in that ability to like drop you right into the setting, into the scene. And that's the kind of feel I was striving for with that book.
Yeah, that's amazing. He actually came to talk when I was in the FBI Academy. It was they were actually really great about bringing in experts and various things. But yeah, he came and talked to our class one night, and it was just wild. But that slice of history that, you know, 30 years later, the history books will give you the 30,000 foot view.
Yeah.
But those little pieces of the reality are so hard to get in on the back end. So, and you being an American, I can see how it would be viewed back in America, but you know, we live by grace of geography and various other, things that have worked in America's favor since, we stumbled onto this rock and started taking it over. But, Americans, I think no matter, even if you're a giant news junkie, you can't appreciate something like the fall of Venezuela or what happened in Somalia. Like, we can read it and people can wave their flags and cheer for selling them guns to let them, whoever wants to win, whoever we want to win, to win. But for the average American, the only way to get that is through when somebody like you takes the time and just paints that picture. It's, but it had to be scary, right? I mean, what, hey, I guess two questions there before I branch too far. How was the, how was that received? Was it, was that accurate or,
Well, yeah, it was received quite well. What was interesting about it was, it was purchased by, Nation Books, which is a part of the Nation magazine, which is a leftist, you know, kind of far left, magazine. But then because they wanted to sort of spotlight, you know, what was going on in these kind of leftist countries. Right. And then when it was published, you know, people on the right are like, look, this is what we warned you about. This is what, you know, what happens when you let socialism go too far. This is when, what happens when you follow the Castro model. Right. So that, so the Economist was like, okay, this is what we've been trying to tell you guys, for years. So that was kind of interesting that it was sort of published by the left, but sort of championed by the right. And my goal was really, like I said, sort of to get out of the way. Cause you, I felt, while I was there, that if I use my voice as the gringo, you know, that nobody's going to believe what I say. So I really tried to just put the points of view of the people who were there, who are both on both sides, of course. I, you know, there's Chavistas, anti-Chavistas, journalists, generals. I tried to put all their points of view in so that the, you could sort of make the reader could sort of make the judgment call. Yeah.
But it's, well, it's funny that you say that, because I wonder if it's even possible for somebody to write a book with that perspective anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. I, as you're saying it, it was like, that's, well, part of me is like, well, yeah, that's how it's supposed to be, objective journalism. But as, as you're saying it, I'm like, he makes a really good point. Cause I don't think, I don't remember the last time I read any kind of reporting on anything that didn't have somebody, some opinion attached to it. It's like opinion. Yeah. So it's, it's, those are important slices when you can capture stuff like that, just to, because down the road, it's not going to exist because there will be a perspective based on it. It's like statistics, right? Statistics can help any argument. Doesn't matter what they are.
Exactly. No, I completely agree. It is a big problem. And, you know, I made my decision. Like I, you know, I went to Venezuela being kind of open-minded about Chavez, you know, because the country had already been through like 15 years of economic decline, which is how Chavez got elected. It was the same kind of idea. Like, we'll give this guy a shot, right? He's, we don't really know much about him, but let's give him a shot, right?
What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah. What's the worst that can happen? Oh yeah. People said that. How could things possibly get any worse?
Hold my beer.
Oh dear. But yeah, the idea that you, sorry, I sort of lost my train of thought there, but the keeping it unbiased, I have made up my mind because I had gotten there and I sort of saw stuff pretty quick. I was like, okay, this is, this guy's dangerous, because there's the left, you know, and then there's the left, which is, and this is the very close to Castro model where violence is okay. Like it's this so far left that like the ends justify the means. We'll do what we have to do to gain power. Right. And that's what I realized. So, you know, I'm not going to say I'm not biased, but I will say that I definitely put everybody's voice in there. I put in the voices of people that I did not agree with. I let them say what they wanted, how they felt. And I just felt that if I put that next to the other perspectives and the truth and the facts, then people would probably come to the same conclusion I did.
Yeah. Or let them come to their own conclusion. You know,
It's right.
Exactly what it is. But I wonder, okay, so it's State Department funded. But in that 72 hours, was it like, were you part of the, were you part of the embassy or were you living on the economy? Like, was there somebody calling you being like, you should probably come in?
Right. So it was, it's a little, we did actually get kicked out. There was a national strike at that time. The whole country shut down and they did send us home for about 4 months. So you do have some connections with the embassy. You get your mail there, you know, but, and in fact, they, some of the people within the embassy helped me connect with some of the people I interviewed, which is very helpful. Oh, yeah. But what's cool about it is that they don't mess with you. They're not asking you to do it in a certain way or, you know, insist that the product comes out the way they want it. There's no sort of review that they do. Once they funded me, they're like, it's your project. You do what you want.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of freedom.
That's
really nice. I can tell you in my line of work that if I want to say anything publicly representing the agency, they're like, oh, right, we get final edit on that.
Right. Of course.
I would never want to do anyway. I'm not a big fan of Spotlight. So.
Right. Yeah. No, that reminds me of what is it? Jawbreaker. Did you ever read that book? Jawbreaker. It's about the agent who guided the Northern Alliance in their initial hunt to get bin Laden. The CIA redacted so much of it that they published it with the black lines on it. So you'll just be turning page after page of black outlines, and then you'll get to the part that is.
It's a great marketing tool.
That is
a conspiracist wet dream.
Right? That's right.
What are they really saying? Yeah. It was there's somebody out there saying that book is code. They're giving us the secrets.
Right. Yeah. Right?
Man, man, to be in a country during that kind of conflict and to see it is just I know it had to be scary and there's a whole lot of unknowns, but just to watch that bit of history had to be something that you were like, man, I fell into this, but I'm gonna take advantage of it. You know?
Absolutely. It's just awesome. I actually describe it with two. I can describe it with two Mel Gibson movies: the Year of Living Dangerously and Mad Max, because that's what it felt like. It just, you know. Right. And there literally were during the strike, there was no gasoline. Like people were literally like trying to siphoning, you know, out stealing fuel out of other people's gas tanks to try to survive. It was nuts. Yeah.
In one of the most oil rich countries in the world.
That's right. That's
exactly right. That's
the ironies are incredible.
The irony is not lost. Right. So, yeah. So you start out, with fiction, did you have a plan? Well, your MFA is in fiction, so
yeah.
So you get the opportunity to do nonfiction, but were you always already working on what the plan was when you went? When you dove into fiction, like did you already have these stories are all mapped out or?
Some of it, yeah. In fact, the first draft of The Last Swordmaker was my thesis for grad school. So it was very rough. It wasn't in very good shape. So the situation was the Silence of the Scorpion came out 2009, 2010, my first son arrived. So I was, and my wife is actually, she's the high powered career one. So I was stuck at home with the child and I'm like, well, I can't go out and do any research. So I'm going to dust off that novel I wrote in grad school and see if I can clean it up. So, as a father, and I know you're still reading it, but it's what I think is really interesting is when I go back and look at that book, The Last Swordmaker, I'm like, whoever wrote this just had children because there's so many themes in the book that are connected to, the motivation of characters to protect children.
Yeah. I picked a bit of that up when he introduced Curtis.
Curtis. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Adam Curtis. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. That's a great example. So he's has to decide whether he's going to, you know, lead this new project. He's kind of like an Andrew Groves of the Manhattan Project kind of thing. If he's going to be the military overseer of this. And he's just watched these sort of horrific images of this new weapon being used in Tibet. He sees all these sort of bodies and cadavers, and there's this one image of a boy who's died in bed, and there's just the outline of the boy's body on the bed sort of conjures this memory of his son in bed. And that's the thing that sort of says, okay, I have to do this because I wouldn't want that to happen to my own child, right?
Yeah, it's just so. the triggering image, especially the background you give him is just that's one of the things we were talking about before, but it's I read a lot. I just, when a book gets you, it gets me within the first 10 pages, I'm like in. And it was just the way he introduced it with like the memo format and just little snippets. I was like, man, I was like, this is going to be good. So that's why I like started reading the third one. I was like, no. I was like, I got to go back. That's why I lost my timeline. I was like, I got to go back to the first one. I don't want to go any further.
No, that's true. That's fun. And it's definitely more fun that way. Yeah. And you'll see a lot of things kind of woven together. I think you'll like lots of little sort of, Easter eggs, I guess, of things. Yeah.
Yeah. So as we were talking, you mentioned 2009, you're putting together your idea for it. The world of 2024 is way different than the world of 2009. So your premise of, nanites, programmable viruses, all that stuff that we, if we see a live science article today saying that we're going to program this virus to go in and kill cancer, we'd be like, well, that makes sense. In 2009, we'd be like, no shit.
Yeah, right.
Did you have to revise your technology estimates at any point or?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that was a little bit of a trick of the book. It's set only 5 years in the future, which is supposed to add to the fear factor, really. It's supposed to make you feel like, okay, this stuff's just around the corner. But then that's a little bit of a gamble because it could actually happen. So I think it's held up pretty well. The only thing was that, it was published in 2018, right? And at that time I said, in the future, you'll be able to use Skype and then you can change the background to anything you want. And I acted like that's a cool
no way.
But that happened pretty fast. So.
Yeah. COVID bounced that office technology right to the stars.
That's right.
I noticed that when I was Overmatch is, I guess there's a piece of techno thriller in it. But I wanted it to be, I just wanted it to be right on the edge of 2023. Like I didn't want to do anything where somebody's like, well, we're not quite there yet. And I didn't want to be like, well, hey, that was pretty cool 2 years ago. So it was like, as I'm writing that line, I'm like, man, as I'm writing it, I'm like, you get further and further into that first draft and you're just like, am I surfing this wave or am I falling off of it? Like,
it was
like, because every time you go on the news, it's like, well, we got this pretty freaking awesome thing and we got drone swarms and we can blast people from space one by one. I'm like, oh God, I'm like, I'm right on the edge. Like the whole time. I'm like, just hit publish on this damn thing. So I can say, it's in the past.
That's right.
There was an unexpected level of stress to trying to ride that line that I didn't expect. Cause I was like, I'm going to write a breakneck race through Jakarta, Indonesia with fun, excitement, and a wise ass protagonist. And, and so that part was fun. And I'm a bad guy was fun, but the mechanisms to keep the story going, that little bits of technology that my Chinese spy is one step ahead of. I'm like, is he still one step ahead or is this something my teenager can use?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's stressful. Well, I was wondering about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely had some angst about that too. And what I kind of try to revert to is as long as you're dealing with themes that are going to resonate and kind of be a little bit more timeless, I think you're okay. You can go back and read The War of the Worlds, for example, which again is trying to predict future technology, right? Yeah. So it's like, this is the turn of the century and H.G. Wells is sort of thinking about the tank. So the tank becomes the Martian walking machine or the gas, World War One was when they used gas for the first time. So he predicted those things. But you don't mind because you can kind of, the greater sort of themes and ideas about technology are still, still work, I guess.
I was wondering if you were having the same problem I was. We're getting into that. And it's another thing that came up was, you started out, you frame it in 2025 and I was just listening to Ray Kurzweil on Joe Rogan like a month ago.
Okay.
And he was like talking about the nanites, and he's talking about the technology and the singularity. And as I'm reading this, I'm like, it's a singularity in the wrong hands, right? So I'm like, man. And he's like, hey, by 2029, you can live forever and you'll be able to do this and program this. And I'm like, son of a bitch. I'm like, and then I'm reading your stuff. I'm like, I don't know. Can we go back to like the 70s? Not the fashion style, but just the cool cars and the lack of connectedness. But there's a creep factor built into your book, right on the edge books, of how quickly things can go wrong. Mm-hmm. And as you know, okay, so you published in 2018, the third one comes out in 2023, and it's how much AI did you put in there? Because was there any consideration for that back then, or did that kind of, are you seeing AI developing, and you're like, oh crap?
Yeah. The third book definitely moved a little bit more into the AI realm than the other two, which had probably been a little bit more nanotech, genetic engineering kind of focus. But yeah, that was actually very fun to sort of think about the analogies. You know, we talked about this idea of children and the protection of children and stuff. So in this third book, one of the more interesting AI takes is that there's this girl, young girl named Emma, and her mother works at the Naval Research Lab. So she has access to this technology. The girl has a genetic disease, a terminal disease. And so the mother, who's kind of just desperate to help her, decides to inject her with these nanocytes that can sort of evolve in her. It's basically gene therapy, essentially, but controlled by an AI that's sort of overseeing it. And that was really fun because, you know, the mother doesn't realize that she's actually given her too much. She thinks that the AI system that was in there to fix the disease has fixed it and then died off, but it hasn't died off. So it's in her. And I really enjoyed that metaphor of AI as an inexperienced child. You know, you think about like training data, you think about how an AI system learns, it fits pretty well with the way that our children learn, right? They have to make a lot of mistakes. There's a lot of bad decisions along the way. There's a lot of fighting between siblings. I hate you. I want to kill you. Right. Yeah. These sort of knee-jerk reactions to things. And you have to sort of wonder if AI is going to behave that way as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And of course, with the child doesn't have access to as much power as an AI system might. An AI system that's, you know, that's part of the defense, Department of Defense, for example.
The whole internet really, at their fingertips. Yeah.
Right. So it's a little bit like the Whopper in the War Games kind of idea, that kind of technology, if it gets connected to the right systems, can really cause havoc. And in my book, I had a little bit of fun with like deep fake, like the deep fake tries to initiate a nuclear strike by impersonating the president and trying to, you know, send the codes. Like the AI is smart enough, with the nanocyte and the swarm technology, the AI is able to not only do a deep fake of the president, but also has the access to the codes. So it almost goes through. Right. So the launch almost goes through. And it's just sort of this skin of your teeth sort of miss. But then the AI changes its direction and figures out another way. It just kind of goes directly to the missile silos. So anyway. Well,
it's funny as you lay that out. It's like, I don't know what you were like in high school, but it was like, I remember do you remember those two dudes that just recorded their prank calls? Jerky Boys.
Okay.
That reminds me of like Jerky Boys, but with exponential trouble and intelligence.
Right. Like, access to the technology teenage, power. Yeah.
The teenage AI being like, you know, it'd be awesome if we can initiate a nuclear strike. That'd be hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah. And that's the stuff that scares me about AI. Cause it's like, I was studying it for another project and then the new book, but when I watched the documentary on it, it was like, you know, I never considered it, because you think, if I think of artificial intelligence, it's like, okay, there's an intelligence and this intelligence has to learn. And as I'm talking to listen to this expert, he's like, yeah, no, there's an intelligence here, but we can mirror it about 1,000 times and have them running the same sequences 1,000 times. So exponentially, it can get to an answer 30 times over before we can even write down our name on a notebook. It's like, God. Give a twisted mind that power, and it's like, there is no fighting that. There is nothing you can do. It's you're already beaten, right? Mm-hmm. But then give it the sinister aspect of a teenager. It's like, oh, we're so screwed.
Yeah. So it's the sum of the numbers, both on the nanotechnology side and on the processing side, are just blistering. Like it is essentially like you can't compete. There's no chance of competing. One of the things, though, so it isn't quite that the AI is like a teenager. I guess in a way it's like a teenager, but in the sense it's an experience. But what I didn't want to do in this book was make AI sinister, sort of wringing hands. So all of the AI in the book actually does exactly what it's programmed to do. But there's several different systems that sort of come in conflict with each other. Each one, and I think this is, you know, kind of true to the way we'll probably destroy ourselves, is that the AI program is technically doing what it's designed to do, but it sort of takes it too far, or as it interacts with other AI systems, it produces something that no one could have predicted or expected. So the culprits in the book are really the people who design these AI systems for their own sort of agendas.
And they can even be benevolent agendas, but it comes down to a rounding error, you know, making a 0.3 instead of a 0.6, and suddenly there's a nuclear launch somehow.
Right.
It's the Office Space analogy. Like he's like the, who's that? Michael, who's the guy in the Office Space that wrote the code to siphon off the money? It was like 2.2 cents. it was a fraction.
That's right.
Oh, God. And then it just destroys the world. It's like, that's just that's the next story, is the rounding error that destroys the world.
Right.
So, that's wild. I'm enjoying it. I'm psyched that I've got three books. I'm psyched that I've got three books ahead of me to get into it. But another point that you made in the book or some of the write-ups and some of the matter discussing it, just the changing face of warfare, and that was something we've seen over the last 20 years of just, you know, there aren't going to be any Battle of the Bulges anytime soon, but there are, you know, strikes, you know, platoon level strikes any given day, or a drone swarm. I mean, last week, what was it, 2 weeks ago, when Iran gave Israel like 10 hours notice and says, we're coming for you. And then everybody just watched on the news all day long. Like it's like the worst worst tailgate ever. Like, it's like, hey, there's a bunch of rockets and a drone swarm coming, but we gave you 8 hours notice.
Right.
Like, I don't think I've seen that before, but that's just the way it is now. It wasn't like they were sending somebody to Tel Aviv. They're like, hey, we're going to launch these things and we'll see if they get them. But nobody seemed to care where these things landed, when they were all shot down, when 99% of them were shot down. Nobody cared about the people who had nothing to do with the conflict living in the middle in the front.
Right. Yeah.
And as some of the discussions in the book were there, it just reminded me of that, because it's probably so fresh in my mind. It's like, you know, everybody, these people who were pushing the buttons, they could care less about the innocent bystanders. And it's like, it was just some of what I was picking up while you were doing that changing face of warfare just takes it to a next level, when it's like, I can engineer something you can't see or do anything about.
Right.
Like, how do we fight that?
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff about, unfortunately, nanotechnology is sort of the, I don't know, the easy way out, the deus ex machina, right? In a lot of stories, right? You know, we need to somehow time warp to the next planet. Oh, okay, we'll just go, the nanosites will do, you know. So I get really annoyed with that. So in the book, I really looked at how it works. And I think I'm doing a much better job of explaining it and how it could be used as a weapon than a lot of other people have. And kind of key to that is that, people think of it as magic. Oh, you know, little nanobots go and they do whatever you want, right? But the basis of the technology is us, which I don't think a lot of people realize, right? So when you flex your muscle and you break your ATP into ADP, that's a protein in your body breaking that down. That's a nanotechnology kind of operation. And of course it's happening, millions of times, in a second, right? And so that speed and that ability to do that is sort of the basis of this. This is why back in the 50s, like Nobel laureate Richard Feynman was saying, this will happen. It's not a question of if it will, it's just, we have to figure out how to do it. So taking that back to the sense of warfare, there's lots of really interesting applications when you merge it with other technologies. So in the second book, I hope I'm not spoiling this for you, but there's a pretty cool combat scene where I'm mixing some of the possibilities of that I researched. One of them is basically to have a functional MRI machine in your helmet, which is something that they're talking about. So basically you can train that to every time you think a phrase, like fire the gun or whatever, that makes a unique path in your brain, and you can train the MRI machine to do that. And it sounds like science fiction, like controlling stuff with your thoughts, but they can already do this with MRIs now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you combine that with a soldier that has swarm technology at his fingertips. He can basically go into a battlefield. He can be watching everything and find the targets he needs to and eliminate them without actually seeing them, which, is kind of in this book, because it's brand new, the soldier is actually there on the field. But of course, it would all, you would think that 6 months later, that wouldn't even be necessary, right?
Yeah.
All you have to do is get the swarm technology there, and then that would take care of it for you, right?
Yep. As long as you can keep the uplink from like Andrews Air Force Base, you can handle it any place in the world, which is even worse. It really makes killing a video game.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. But all that stuff exists already. It's like, mm-hmm. that's just frightening. That's what it is with you right on that edge. It just makes that potential. You take the potential that can do great things, and just, it's so scary. It's so scary when you think about it. Yeah.
Right. Right. So looking at the books as kind of the 1, 2, 3, right? So the first book is this arms race with China where, the technology, we have to make the technology or China will make it, right? So we have to rush, we have to do it, which in itself is fascinating. The importance of the mission, becomes almost more important than what we're doing, right? We have to finish, we have to do it, which is very much what happened with the Manhattan Project, with the bomb. I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet, so I don't know if they cover this in the movie, but there was a moment when they were working on the bomb, and we basically figured out the Germans had never been close, that we didn't have to worry. We weren't in a race with the Germans, and we knew the Japanese weren't doing it either. We knew we were the only ones who were close. And there was a celebration at Los Alamos. All of the scientists celebrated. They took a couple days off. And then 3 days later, they're all back to work, working 80 hours again, because they wanted to know if they could do it.
Yep.
So anyway, at the end of the first book is the technology, the US wins, right? They essentially beat China. And so now they have the technology. And the second book is much more about how different people come in and try to use it, high-level people in the military, other people are trying to steal it, a terrorist is trying to get her hands on it. So it's very much this idea of the technology is, as I mentioned before, not so much to blame, it's the people trying to get power and get their hands on the technology.
Yeah, it always goes back to Jurassic Park. Jeff Goldblum saying, "You guys are so excited to see if you can do something, you never think about if you should."
Right.
And I mean, in 2024, it's I used to think that I would want to be born in like the Wild West or like medieval times. I was like, no, this is like this, the world could change tomorrow. And we'd be like, yeah, I saw that coming. Like, it's just, we're at this point with technology that we're just like, who knows, who knows what's happening next Thursday, but it can be awesome or it could, you know, be exponentially bad, but it's still possible right now. It's all possible.
Let me ask you about that gap, right? So if you were to chart sort of human evolution, it would be like sort of flat, right? And then you have, you know, the evolution of our machines is a sort of J curve, right? Where we're really ramping up. One of the things that I'm always been interested in is that gap. The bigger the gap gets between the power of our creations or the evolution of machines and the evolution of humans, the more sort of miserable I think on some level we become, right? We feel our sense of power or our sense of worth diminish even though our machines are becoming more and more powerful. So you know, I don't know, you know, we talk about like mental health crises, the problems with social media, feelings of isolation even though we're more connected than any other time in history. I think it has a lot to do with, you know, technology, which, you know, you see every little advance, you're like, oh, that's great. Now we can do this. And that's great. Now we can do this. But when you take all that stuff in aggregate, what does it mean to us as individuals and as a species? Right.
Yeah. And, I think if, I don't know if you have the same problem I do at home, but I remember when we were growing up, and I hope I'm not like, look at my gray hair. I hope I'm not overshooting your generation at all. But, you know, we would go to school and, say it's high school. We'd be, everybody'd be talking about Friends or everybody'd be talking about Seinfeld. Everybody'd be, if it was junior high, everybody's talking about 90210 or Melrose, or the A-team when we're in middle school, whatever.
Right.
Now, I don't know about you, but I'll let my guys jump on their pads for a little while before bed. And my wife is on Reels. My six-year-old is watching Little League Baseball on YouTube. And my 11-year-old is watching how to 3D model a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. And I'm like, and I'm just sitting there with the two cats and we're just like, I'm like, all right, I'll put on SportsCenter. See what you guys want to do. But everybody's off doing their own thing. So I think about it now and I'm like, how do you guys, like the kids at school, I'm like, what'd you guys do today? And none of them are like at the water cooler talking about how funny Friends was last night. They're all watching their own desperate YouTube channels and there is none of that. But when you think about that spike in technology, I don't know when it happened, but it seems like you go to work now and you can't do anything without your computer. I mean, unless, and I don't know, it probably varies by industry, but every system at work is tied into something I need to feed my freaking machine for. And it's like just awful. But yeah, I mean, I think prosperity, I think there's probably a link between prosperity and self-worth maybe. Because there is no stress on the population, just does not face the stress or the challenge that we used to, because a lot of us get handed things and it could be a generational thing. It could be a whole lot of variables that go into it. But yeah, that you look at the mental health crisis and you look at a lot of things facing our society, I think it's because everything's at our fingertips. So how do you find, if you're teenage to mid 20s, how do you find meaning in something if all you do is sit and type on a keyboard all day?
Right, right.
And who teaches you to go outside? Who forces you to go outside and walk through the woods and leave your device at home? Like,
right.
It's hard.
No, and I think a good way to think about that is how are you programmed? Like we're following a program that is inconsistent with our design, right? A human being was not designed to sit in front of a screen, a light source for 8 hours a day. It was not designed to sit in a car in traffic for 2 hours. You know, you were designed to be outside almost all day. You were designed to be moving all day long. In the second book, I play around, it takes place in Africa, but I kind of play around a lot with that idea of how you were designed to live versus the way you're forcing yourself to live. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a section of the book where he's basically Eric Hill, the protagonist, is living with a primitive tribe. And he, as someone who's dedicated his life to technology, sort of begins to sort of ask himself these questions, you know, it's like, what am I here for? What am I designed to do? And I had some fun with the idea of hunting, because whether you're talking about hunting as hunter gathering, you know, looking for food, foraging for food, or whether you're talking about hunting as, you know, hunting a wild animal, that's a skill that everyone had to have, right? Oh, yeah. You wouldn't be here if people in your family, people in your ancestry were not very good at hunting. You know, and what is hunting? Hunting is, okay, I go out and I find a track in the ground. Oh, there's a clue. And then I look around and I see other pieces of evidence, like, oh, here's some scat or whatever. So this sort of like clue after clue after clue leads you to prosperity, leads you to food, right? And then you sort of take that and you're like, oh, well, what is watching TV? Like, if I turn on TV, what's the story about? Oh, it starts off, there's a dead body. Oh, what, there's a commercial break. Oh, now there's another clue, and now another clue. So a lot of the things we view as sort of, you know, normal narrative or things that give us pleasure are actually linked to this ancient pattern of find a clue, find another clue, figure this thing out. Oh, there's food. I can eat it. You know, so it's. I think some of our sort of programming has been hijacked, or sort of, you know, primitive programming has been hijacked by, you know, stories, you know, watching binging on Netflix or,
right.
or, you know, looking at things on social media to give you a little dopamine boost. Right. So, it's interesting stuff. Yeah.
As you're saying that, I'm like, man, I think he just solved the riddle of why true crime is so popular.
Yeah.
Every episode of 48 Hours just starts with that little trickle and keeps you going right to the end.
Exactly.
Following the scat literally to the dead body. Right. that's a premise right there. You just solved the mystery of true crime. It's like, why is it my wife falls asleep when I'm watching football, but can't turn away from Snapped?
That's right. You got to know. Yep. You can't go to bed till you know. You got to find out
who did it. Who did it? You got to get. You got to get the prize. You got to win the prize. You got to shoot that animal. That's funny. I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that against her tonight, actually. You know, you're just igniting your nascent primitive hunter sense when you're watching true crime.
That's right. Exactly.
Nice. So yeah, with this, the Course of Empire series, is this, is it a trilogy, or you got more on the books?
So this wraps up pretty well at the end. I left a few loose ends that I can use, but that would be actually up to the publisher if they want to go with another book. They're not knocking at my door right now, so we'll see how that goes.
They're a really fun bunch.
Yeah, it's been a really fun series. I mean, and the core of it was, you know, coming off of my experience in computers and looking at the way technology was growing. Again, this was like the year 2000, right? When I quit my job in IT. But that's sort of the seed, right? The seminal idea is a cautionary tale about technology and how we better be careful about what we create. Yeah,
and it might be coming true, you know, next Tuesday. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows at this point? So what are you doing next?
So this is interesting, because I saw that you've written some fantasy books. So I
have ADHD. I have genre ADHD. That's what
Yeah. I also am. So I've started a fantasy, high fantasy book. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm really enjoying it. I've got some pretty cool characters that I'm really liking. I wasn't sure if I would like them, but I'm now kind of really falling in love with them. Some of the basic premise is that there's a, you know, an evil sort of empire that's sort of sweeping through. And there's this one realm has been demolished, basically. And all of the important people have been sort of become exiles. And one of them, they need one of them to sort of go on a mission, right? So, and what it's about, what the initial idea is, it's actually like a midlife crisis book. Nice. Because all these wonderful things happened to these people when they were young, but they lost it all because this other empire came in. And so this is sort of the second chance for this group, and particularly this one character who lost a lot. So it mirrors a little bit true life, you know, as I'm now 54. So I'm looking at life in that sort of the second, you know, the second half, right?
Yeah,
and what you're going to do with the second half, knowing that you don't have as many chances to redo it as you did when you were younger, right? You're young, right. You screw up. You're like, oh, that's all right. I got it. I can do it again, which is also interesting in a fantasy realm, because if you're human in the fantasy realm, you only got, you know, 80 years to live. If you're an elf or another species that lives longer, then you're like, oh, whatever. I've still got 400 years to go, kind of thing. So the main character is human, and he's got to deal with kind of what he's going to do with this, with the second half. Yeah.
Yeah. I always, my fantasy, I wanted to play with the genre, and I've just had to do Die Hard in a Castle.
Okay.
I was like, this, but I wanted to take just the guy you really want to see punched in the face. And I just wanted to see what decisions are you going to make? So I actually outlawed magic in, in my realm. I left it open. Like, there's a sliver of it. Uh-huh. I left it open for a sequel. Cause I did, like you said, you grow to love the characters. Cause I did it as an experiment. I wanted to try the genre.
Yeah.
But as I'm doing, I'm like, man, these guys are so much fun. And I already have like a couple mapped out, because I had to jump back over to the crime thriller. And then after that, I find that if I jump, because at one point my plan was to just write a series of crime thrillers. But my brain works in a different way. So I find I write two crime thrillers, and part of my head is just like, jump back into the horror. I'm like, okay. But it feels so good to kind of step out of that world and into a new one. And then it's just a refreshing feeling to change your universe for a minute.
Right. It's harder than I thought. Like, the world building is hard. Yeah. Like, making up names that don't sound goofy and stuff like that. That is hard work. And I am working with a magic system. It's not crazy. It's not like super powerful. But yeah, you've got to kind of make a lot of rules. And you're like, okay, I know a lot of people have done this before, but I also want to make it unique to me, right?
So you don't want to fall into the trap.
Exactly. Well, you know, what's interesting about it, though, is that you know your reader is going to bring a lot to the table already. Right. Yep. So if I say a wizard walked into the room, and the mental image of that wizard is already in the reader's mind, you actually don't have to do a lot of describing. So there's a pros and cons of it, I guess. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. As long as you don't start calling people Gandalf and that was a step too far.
That's right. Exactly.
I always did like, and I do have a couple ideas mapped out to start using like Fey or the elves and stuff like that in one of my series. But I always liked the way that, what was it, Legolas or whatever, the elves in the Tolkien's always like were entertained by the humans as like the same way I'm entertained when my 6-year-old goes nuts and starts jumping off the couch. In the same instance, they look on humans with pity because they only have 80 years. There's such stuff to play with there. It's just so great. You know, those two worlds in different timelines, but living together.
Right.
That's going to be fun. That should be fun.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, but Tolkien, he was the first one to make elves big. You know, before Tolkien, elves were always assumed to be like, you know, 2 feet tall, 3 feet tall.
I never thought of that. Yeah,
and he had made this history of elves, and then all his buddies were like, yeah, I just don't see this. This is too goofy. They're just too small. So he just said, okay, I'll just make them, you know, kind of, you know, fair, angelic, slightly angelic humans. And now that's become the default what we think of as an elf. But any literature you look at before, 1900 is going to be elves are like, elves and dwarves are just little random pixies or sprites that run around.
Yeah. Tricksters that steal little kids in the middle of the night. And now they're the superior race from a higher realm.
Right. So, exactly.
All right. It looks good on screen.
Yeah, so, it does.
that's going to be fun. I don't know how much down a research rabbit hole you've gone though, but I lost days of my life, like learning the terminology for just the clothing and the weapons. Mm-hmm. And
right.
I lost a whole day to learn about horses just to write a passage on going from one castle to another. It's like, oh God.
Yeah.
I'm running back to the cop genre just to
because you already got all the data in your head. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's good. I mean, you're learning as you do it, but it is a lot of like, oh, I never knew that. What's a destrier? Yeah. What's that?
Right? Yeah. I'm supposed to be writing right now. Instead of I'm learning about a Palomino.
Yeah.
Yeah. But man, that's awesome. And I hope when you come back, that's why I rebranded to writer stuff. So I wasn't stuck in that criminal world. It was, I could just talk to writers over every genre, So,
right.
But when you get done with that one, that is a question. I know we're coming up on an hour, but when you get done with that one, I want to talk to you about that too. But with your publisher, I wanted to know when you told them you want to write you want to hop genres, what kind of pushback have you gotten, or has that even been a conversation?
That hasn't been a conversation yet. I mean, I feel like with a novel, as you got to get it pretty much done before anybody's going to look at you or take you seriously. So I am just basically working on it, and hopefully they'll come begging for it, right now, along with several other publishers, and movie scouts when we come to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just wondering because it's as I'm chatting with people, especially I pretty much ignored the business side of this business for like 7 years. I was just like, oh, this sounds like a fun story. I'm going to write that. I'm going to write this. And I talked to people who actually went in with a business plan and they're like, oh, you never hop genres. You should have a pen name for your horror, a pen name for your crime, a pen name for this. And I was like, nah, I didn't do any of that. I'm like, they say that fans won't hop from one genre to the next. But I think if you write a fun enough book, they're going to read it. Right.
Right.
And if not,
right.
just make more fans. It's like there's billions of people out there.
So, right.
I love it. I love it when people hop genres. It's so much fun to just get out of the element.
Yeah, I agree. And part of what you're saying is my thinking too. I was like, well, if somebody wants to publish it or not, I'm still going to write it. So it doesn't really matter. I'm going to do it the way I want to anyway. And that's something that I decided pretty early on, like even in grad school, I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to write something specific, just for that marketing side of it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spend a year or a year and a half of my life on something that I don't really want to do. Or I'm not excited about.
That'll do nothing but snuff out the art. You're not going to, if you're writing for a market, you're not going to push to see what if I switch this beat with that beat. And if I change the plot around and just do it backwards or sideways, nobody's going to do that if they're writing for a market. I understand the business side, and I have failed in the business side because I want to be a writer, but I'm slowly being like, hey, be an adult about this. Maybe try and look at it as a business. I'm getting there, but I'm slow to pick things up.
Well, I mean, in a way, I think we're probably on the same page in the sense that the therapeutic side of it, or the passion side of it, outweighs the marketing anyway, right?
Yep.
If you wanted to just kind of make money, you could just start loading a bunch of ideas into ChatGPT and probably crank something out pretty fast that would probably do okay, right? But it wouldn't be, you wouldn't have had the labor of love of making it, and it wouldn't be your true voice, right?
Right. Yeah. It wouldn't be art. It wouldn't. And, but yeah, that's, it's, yeah, that first and foremost, it's got to be for us. It's got to be something we want to read. So,
right.
But, no, man, that's awesome. And, yeah, seriously, when you wrap that thing up, come back and, chat with me about it.
Will do. But, absolutely. Absolutely.
Awesome. We've been going about an hour. So I'm going to let you go. But I do, before I go, it's, I've got BrianNelsonBooks.com.
Yes.
For people to find you. And then, IG is Brian Nelson author underscore between each word. And then on X is Brian underscore A underscore Nelson. If I got you. All right.
Excellent.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you very much for joining me.
No, John, it's a pleasure. Really nice talking to you.
Absolutely. All right. Good night, everybody.